Listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by West Wave Audio, LA's new API dealer. And now from the Nowcast Network studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over to my right, I've got Martin Page.
How you doing?
And then we've got Scott Gershon.
Wow.
You just woke him up.
What are you, hibernating? And then last but not least, we've got Rob Arbitier.
Hello.
Bobby is not with us. Neither is Andrew. What about Andrew? We make him a panel member and then he calls in sick.
He was here once in a row.
Bobby's not here, but we are going to call him right now because he said, hey, can't you do a phone patch or something? So I'm going to call Bobby right now. We're going to get him on the line.
Straight through to the asylum. You should go straight through. Cubicle one.
Functioning provided by Trio Verizon, right?
This is exciting.
The Futz filter.
Here we go.
Okay. Oh, that's him.
We can see why he's ditching. Bobby. Hey, can you hear us?
Mikey, yes, I can hear you, my man.
Hey, man, we want to know why you're not with us, man. You were the star of the last show, and then what? No love?
And you guys are okay?
Yeah, we're good.
We're actually much better that you're not here, Bob, tell you the truth.
Well, I can imagine that you are. Absolutely. I'm so sorry, Mike. Tonight and next week is looking bad for me. But I'm coming back, I promise.
You sound like you're in the bathroom. Is that your studio?
Well, I'm in my living room. I'm just going upstairs, taking a bit of a break. I'm nipping out for dinner. And
how about that?
You've got otherwise I would have been in the bathroom a couple of minutes later.
Going out to have dinner and you're not with us? Gracious me.
I know. Can you please cut? What kind of priority is that?
All right.
You know something? I'm sure you, if you are recording this, you know I'm with my mate here, who's a really great writer, piano player, musician, and he's played all his life. He's a monster player. But, very interesting thing, a sign of the times. I'm going to put him, it's a podcast.
Okay.
I'm just telling him a little bit about it. And his name's Tom Regis. And he plays around town still, but over the last 5 years, 4 years, right, he went to school and studied and got his degree in law. And now he's a bona fide lawyer. So anything you say may be taken down and used against you.
That's right.
But my point is that...
Yeah, get to the point. Yeah, come on.
My point is, I just chucked this in. It's a shame that the music industry is discarding a lot of the live players in lieu of loops and I know that at some point you stopped entirely, but because there's a lot of less work, you get all these great musicians going off and doing other things.
That's like, double tragic if we're replacing them with lawyers too.
Yeah.
Hi y'all.
Hey, nice to meet you.
Hey, this is our first live remote, so we better have more to say than this.
Are you keeping Bobby out of jail or something?
Hey, well, listen, we're going to get on with the podcast. So, is Bobby there? And we will, you know, you got to come down and visit with us one of these days, and we'll do it live with you in the studio and talk about your career change.
That sounds good. Career edition, not change.
Oh, well, that's true. Career edition. Let's put that.
Cross-dressed, you didn't mention that, but...
That's good. Yeah, about time.
Bobby?
Yeah, my bro.
All right.
Oh, he's back.
You take it easy, and we'll talk to you later, all right?
All right, my bro. Sorry to miss you tonight, you guys.
Yeah, sure you are.
Okay, we'll catch you next time.
All right, my mate. Thank you. I'll see you Sunday. I won't see you tomorrow either, mate.
Oh, okay. I'll see you on Sunday, baby.
All right, my son. Cheers, mate.
Cheers, mate.
Bye.
Bye, Scott. Bye, Rob.
See ya.
Ciao.
Okay, well, that was Bobby, and he's going out to dinner, and I don't know. I think that was kind of fishy that he was going out to dinner and he's not here, but that's okay.
What's he
going to
eat?
I have no idea.
We didn't get that far.
But moving on, we're going to cover a couple things, but before we go, we get into it, and one of the things we're going to be talking about tonight is alternative controllers for mixing and for music. Two things happened this week that I want to share with you guys. Number one, I picked up a PDA this week. I actually got this little Hewlett-Packard PDA. And while I was online, they have a music program by a company that you can download over the internet. And the name of the program is called Syntrax. It's like having an Ableton Live composing system in the palm of your hand. And it got me thinking about technology and where things are going. And I wanted to talk to you guys. Have you ever considered, you know, where technology is going to be in 5 or 10 years, the fact that maybe you'll be working from your big studios to something like this? I mean, could you ever see yourself working on any type of Palm device to do not only to capture your sound effects, but to also edit your sound effects and the field, you know? Or Rob, if you're on an airplane, you know, and you need to do some composing, I mean, do you ever see music creation going to where you'll be seeing yourself working off something like this?
I mean, I actually have done that. I have a little Yamaha music composing system. It's, I don't know, maybe 4 inches by 6 inches. I forget the model name, the QI something, I think. But I've taken that on airplanes with a little tiny MIDI keyboard. I mean, you still have to be able to play something, but I have a little Yamaha MIDI keyboard that has keys that are maybe 3/4 normal size. It's playable.
Right.
And I have written stuff on airplanes because this thing has a sound source and sequencer built into it, and it's a great way to work. The problem is, as these things get smaller and smaller, at some point there has to be some kind of user interface. I mean, no matter what the resolution, you can't have a screen the size of a postage stamp and expect to, you know, do mixes on it or something.
You know, I was reading an article where the watch manufacturers were discussing their future because they came up with these amazing watches that could pretty much do everything. The problem was nobody wanted them because it was so small. Mm-hmm. That they had the power, but the usage was like, look, you got a typewriter who can use a little pin to hit all of the letters, and nobody was interested in it. So I think that it comes down to convenience. And when I think when it's too big, it's not convenient. I also think when it's too small, it's not convenient. I think that it's just got to find, it's like, you know, the three bears. You just got to find it just right, you know, and I think that, you know, some of the fold-out keyboards I've seen where they actually fold out and they become a little keyboard. But the reality is it becomes bigger than what it is. I think weight, size, some things make sense. I mean, when I do location recording, sure. You know, I've already got a couple recorders that are pretty much the size of a deck of cards. But when I'm editing, nah. I mean, as it is, I don't have enough information on a 27-inch, you know, monitor or, you know, some of the different computers. I got multiple, computer monitors. There's so much information that you want to see, be able to react to.
But, you know, they do have wave editors for this where you can pull up and see the waveform. And, like, if you're in the field and you're recording, you know, a bunch of gunshots, let's say, and you just wanted to do a quick edit and things like that.
But it's always going to be your mobile version of what you're doing in your real studio. I can't picture, basing all your work around that. I think of that as a convenient gadget for when you're out of the office. But the most important thing about that gadget is how it integrates to what you use every day in the office.
See, because I think, you know, you look at something like the iPod, okay? The iPod right now plays music, but what's to stop Apple from coming out with, you know, they'll come out with a video iPod, and then next thing you know it, there's a version of GarageBand for the iPod, and next thing you know it, you know, people are composing, you know.
But I think yeah, you're talking about the Walkman. I mean, you hit record, you play, you get something going, but again, the screen is a limiting factor.
They may get it to the point where something like the iPod, you know, you could plug a cinema display into it when you're back in your studio. You know, you might be able to do that someday.
Yeah.
In which case, then you're away from the little postage stamp
right.
But
screen.
You know, going back to the watch scenario, one thing I saw that was interesting that the watch people are going to be doing is, you know, those little USB memory sticks?
Right.
They're putting them in watches. So what you do, because they're saying a lot of people don't want to walk around with these around their neck and their pocket, so they've made it where you unclip something in your watch.
Yeah.
You plug it into your computer, you download all the files you want, and it lives in your watch. All of a sudden I went, well, yeah, it's useful. It kind of makes sense. I guess it comes down to what function will it solve.
The thing is also, as computers get more powerful, the software manufacturers keep using the power so that every new generation of computers that comes out, everybody says, oh, this is so fast, we can never harness all this power. And then everybody comes out with the next version of their software, and all of a sudden these computers don't seem so fast anymore. And that's always going to be the leading edge. And with these pocket devices, they're never going to have, because of power and heat and all the other considerations, they're never going to have the power of a bigger computer. So the people who are doing serious work are always going to have – they're always going to be chained to a more powerful system. And I think that the small gadgets are always going to be just the mobile end to their work. But, I mean, even if – let's say an iPod-sized device was powerful enough to do a massive – sequence and audio recording and everything else. Well, great. To do that work, I'm still going to want to hook it to a giant screen or screens. I'm still going to need to hook it to a big keyboard if I'm doing sequencing. You know, the fact that maybe the device that's getting recorded on is really tiny isn't so important in the studio. I just always think there are going to be those two worlds.
You know what? I have a feeling that people are going to start using audio in new and exciting ways, and you're going to see a lot of things like little palm devices and just other uses for audio. And, you know, being that this is the Audio Nowcast, we talk about audio. I was on a mission this week for one of my clients, and I had to find a solution so that I could trigger audio files off of GPS at specific locations. And I found that solution actually with this Pocket PC and some software. But it got me thinking, what if there's a car player and you could download songs and you can create trips where you're driving and certain songs are being triggered along the road.
So as soon as you drive into Colorado, it automatically plays Rocky Mountain High?
Seriously, but I mean, think about that. I mean, that's just – I mean, the way all this technology is kind of getting together, you know, what if you go up the coast and you know, you can program in your coastal route and you know what, you know.
Smart roads.
Exactly. I mean, it's just – it's really phenomenal when you start thinking about audio out of the box. Just where it can all go and how it's going to affect us. I mean, we're going to be doing stuff with audio that you've never thought you would be doing.
I think on a consumer level, absolutely. I think that because the consumer's needs are obviously very different than what ours would be. But on a consumer level, yeah, any kind of gadget like that, there's definitely enough horsepower in a small gadget now to do that kind of audio work.
But also as the producers like we are, like Martin, you know, right now you're a songwriter, but there may be some time where you're doing music for something interactive, be it, you know, a museum display or something. I mean, you just don't know. What's happening is the whole songwriting, you know, producing music and for trailers and things like that, you know, as that market kind of gets squeezed budget-wise, there's going to be other things that are filling it. And I think we're going to be doing stuff, producing audio for things that we just never even thought we were going to be doing.
I just think that human eyeballs on complex work need a display.
Well, you know, something on the display side, I think two things that one of the things I like to do is MIT comes out with a technology journal, which is actually made for consumers. Not, you know, and what they talk about is all these innovations that are being worked on. One thing that I thought was amazing, they have a chip that's actually a laser projector. And it actually can project. The reason they're building it is for inventory, so you can actually see things. But one of the things they're finding is monitors, and people don't always have access to displays. So what they're finding is this gentleman created a chip, it's still in the development stage, that can project. It's basically a mini laser projector on the wall.
So yeah,
and it doesn't have to be a flat or a flat or white wall.
That's what they're talking about big time. And so, in the future is that everything's going to be on walls. As you walk into your house, you're going to see everything you want. You'll touch the wall and your computer screen will come up on the wall. Your whole house will become active.
Well, projection is one solution for a small device to have a good user interface.
All of a sudden, the other one is another technology which the military is using is a projector that basically goes into your retina. So when you do it, basically everything that you can see disappears.
Or you go
blind.
And
what you do?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to beta test that.
So then you could basically, whether it's pictures, whether it's computers, the screen could be as big as you want based on how you're looking.
Or something that goes across your eyes.
Or just moving your hand and all of a sudden you're moving the screen. I mean, there's so many ways of being able to go to solve the screen issue. I think the big thing that we're dealing with, we got the memory thing going, we got the CPU issues done, batteries, power. I mean, trying to make a power source that's small enough that could power all these really cool things that we've got, I think that's the limiting factor that we're dealing with right now.
Yeah, power is a problem. Heat dissipation is a problem as processors get faster. Another display solution that I've seen early talk about or heard early talk about is the LCDs that you can actually roll up like a newspaper and stick in your pocket. So you could actually have a big screen that you just unroll and put on the table where you're working, because projection obviously doesn't help you outdoors, you know, during daylight in the middle of nowhere. But if you could have an LCD screen, a cinema display that you have folded up in your pocket and then you just lay it out to work, that would be pretty cool.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think the display problems and the interfaces will all be, you know, will be worked out. And I think there's just going to be some really interesting opportunities for audio. I mean, think about this. Think of, you get a car and your car has a Wi-Fi system embedded into it. And as you're driving, you could have hotspots along the highway and you can get your music. Or if you're satellite, you could do, not only it'll feed you your audio, but it'll feed you your audio at specific points. You know, I should just patent this.
Step one to patenting it is to announce it in a public forum.
But you know what the thing is? You know, what's the one keyword, Rob, that you've got that they built a PC into a keyboard and...
Oh, the Open Labs Nico?
Yeah. You know, what I think is going to happen is, I don't think it's as much as how small are we going to make it, but I think it's going to be how portable can we get it and how easy can it be. Because before, with MIDI cables and you had multiple modules, you had to put them together, you had to get a CPU, hard drives, it was noisy, then you had to get something that, you know, all of these issues. I think what's going to happen is you're going to have a band in a box, really small, really light, really easy. And you're going to be, you know, right now we were all talking that the days of having these mega, you know, I've got all the equipment in the walls and synths everywhere and all that. Sorry, Rob. Now you've got these like sterile white rooms where you've got one keyboard, two or three monitors, speakers.
And you can tap into everything.
And that's it. And that's all you need, because everything's soft. And the days of a lot of knobs and stuff, you know, I'm seeing a lot of composers now that just have really simple rooms. Don't have a lot of stuff going. They don't need it anymore because everything's virtually on the screen. My God, 10 years ago, that wasn't even an option.
Mm-hmm. I just think that there's, you know, exciting times and things are going to be changing. And I don't know how they're going to be changing, but apparently someone's going to make $1 million.
Well, you've given a lot of ideas. That's
insane. Yeah, really. off the ideas that are... yeah, I'm just kicking myself
right now. I remember when I started getting involved in gaming, what I thought was exciting, at the very beginning, everybody had virtual helmets, they had gloves that you can control things with. It seemed to be this huge pouring of control devices. And everyone went, they're kind of silly. But now the CPUs have gotten fast enough, I don't see them around as much. The drumsticks... Virtual drums, and it was all of this like
except guitar hero.
5 year, 5 year period where it was almost like everybody was coming out with a really cool alternative controller, and maybe it was too soon.
Well, part of the problem is too. It turns out the concept of a keyboard or drum pads works great. You know, most people aren't going to buy some crazy weird controller.
Except for me.
Well, except for you. Well, and we may be getting ahead of ourselves.
No, but that's okay. But because, you know, there's two things as we're talking about this that come to mind is, number one, how people force technology upon you that you may not want, because people may not want Wi-Fi in their car and be fed songs. And it reminds me of this company that tried to do this little module, USB module, that you plug into your computer and you'd go to websites and it would be able to replicate an aroma. So basically this little box.
I heard about that too.
I mean, I could not think of a more useless piece of technology than AromaVision. You know? Because I don't want to smell my computer, you know? And it's not going to be the actual computer. It's not going to be the actual thing. You're smelling a replica of what the computer thinks that is. And it's just amazing how technology gets to the point where you know, some of this stuff is just, well, like you were talking, Martin, about, you know, your email, how your internet's gone down.
Yeah.
And you depend on it so much, and now that you don't have it, it's like...
You don't realize because you start to really lean on these things. And, you know, since my internet went down, and as you'd set up for me in my studio where we'd had the wireless set up, you know, it was like, how can I live for 3 days without my computer? It's just, yeah. It's just not on, you know. But, you know, I had to really think about that, and I thought, hey... This is a computer, and all I'll be getting is my emails. I think I can live for 3 days without this. Let's pick up a guitar, you know. And those, in a way, I think it was quite a philosophy for me to go like, hey, you know, don't get too distraught by this. This is something that isn't really, really that important. Yet, you know, you start to depend on these things. Listening to you guys talk as well, I really feel like it's almost a period of gimmicks. There's a tremendous amount of, you know, what can people carry around in their pockets? You know, 3 or 4 different things, you know, small. And they're not as small anymore. I'm looking at the table here with what you've brought out, Mike, here. And these are quite big units. These telephones have got a little bit bigger. And there's a tremendous time of gimmicks. The more that you can carry, the more that you can be doing 4 or 5 things at once. And I think, as Rob was saying, for the consumer, thrilling. For the songwriter and maybe the engineer, it's a slightly different vision all around, you know. So you have to really say, what's the middle way between this? Is this useful to me creatively? Or is this a gimmick? You know, and will I really be using this? You know, will I really be, you know, spending? And really, people are not looking at, here I go into the philosophy again, but they're not really looking at the world. They're looking at small, very small screens all day and multitasking. That doesn't mean that you're being creative. It just means you're being consumed, you know.
Well, that's true, too, because after a while, you get around all this technology and all this stuff, and my computer bag no longer just has a computer. It has the phone, and it has the, you know, the PDA.
Well, think about this. Suppose you get a handheld device that's powerful enough to record a concert 96 tracks wide, okay? You're going to record a major multimedia event on this thing in your pocket. Well, you still need 96 mic pres, you know, and you still need so much other technology to go around it that who cares if the device you're recording onto is the size of a deck of cards or a rack of computers. It doesn't make a difference in that end of the market. So, yeah, it would be really cool to be able to go out in the field someplace and record something amazing into your watch and then bring it back to your real system and import it.
But isn't it amazing, though, like right before I came here, I was looking at my phone and I had to make some phone calls and I was doing business. Isn't it amazing how when you look at the new technology and the old technology, like I've got my Trio. I can go in, do numbers. Then I'm looking at my office phone, and I'm looking at it going, dial this number. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have a directory. Mm-hmm. It's actually really dumb. Then you look at it and go, wait a minute. I've got all these computers. I've got all these gadgets. I've got a phone that's so far behind. I'm thinking, do they make cell phones, but do they make normal office phones and home phones that are as smart?
They do now. They do.
Do they?
Yeah, they do, finally.
A little video pod that goes in the phone, and you can say.
Well, they make phones that have directories built in and all that stuff now. But you know, most people are just using their cell phones.
But does it like? But can you just interconnect it to Bluetooth or Wi-Fi? Okay, I'm now behind.
You mean you don't hang out at Circuit City every day?
That's right. Hey, okay, really quick, cell phones, and then we're going to move on. But I don't know about you guys, but since I have a directory in my cell phone, like. I forget numbers left and right because, you know, I'm so used to just clicking on their name and dialing it, you know, that I won't remember people's numbers. So, hey, give me the number for so-and-so, and if I don't have my cell phone with it,
Do you find, guys, that now you're totally consumed by data management? I just upgraded to Pro Tools 7. I said, what was your passcode the last time you logged in 3 years ago to a plug-in website? I don't remember.
Oh, yeah.
I don't even remember the product. I got to find the box. It's probably at Rob's house. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden you find that you're spending all this time managing the data, managing the plugins, and you're actually not doing anything creative. You're just trying to get the next update, which you found out you shouldn't have done because it actually doesn't work.
Yeah.
Password management. I can't tell you how often me and Martin at his studio, every time we have to upgrade, we're always trying to remember what the passwords are.
And for someone like me who will spend, you know, a good 6 months writing a few more songs, when Mike comes back to the studio and we want to update, it's been a long time, you know, because I've got lost in something else. And as you say, you go back and forwards. And then to me, it's a real big deal. I think there's a real – for me personally – a real danger in getting too much stuff. I really like to walk into a room and see maybe four or five pieces of electrical equipment, a Pro Tools setup, something that's good technology, but around that I like to see a couple of guitars and some stuff where you can just start writing straight away. Of course, I'm coming from the writing side of it, but I find that it's actually quite scary, some of the technology that continually gets pushed in front of you. It stops you from getting that human element of creativity across. And that's really where I'm coming from. So I really have to sort of say, push that back. We'll use that at a later stage, but it's not the first thing that should be in my front line of attack. You look at Bruce Springsteen, you know, doing the Seeger sessions. You go right back to that, and people really feel that. They go, hey, this is something that isn't, there's not a veil in front of it of technology. You can't walk away from technology, but for me as a writer, it's almost like it's quite a dangerous jungle. It's like it's staring at me saying, I want to tempt you with some more colors. And I almost have to say, don't put that in front of me now. You know, let me keep the palette a little clearer, because I think there's a big fuzz zone of everything you can just, you know, be doing that isn't creative. You can be pushing knobs and for days on end.
Do you find that, like...
And looking for passwords and books.
I know. Lately I've been finding, like, we said, hey, well, Yahoo widgets. This is really cool. You put up Yahoo widgets. Then all of a sudden they're like, do you want the 7.8 version? Then there's the Beta 8.2 version. You go, no, thank you. Great. Mm-hmm. You asked me once, it was very polite. Then every, like, 5 minutes, it comes up. Are you sure? Mm-hmm. You sure you don't want it? Mm-hmm. Then you load it, and you go, fine, you do it. Now nothing works. Your system's crashing. Then you uninstall it, and it doesn't really uninstall. And then all of a sudden, you're fighting all these things to go, leave me alone. Go away.
But you're involved. You're in.
You're sitting there, and you're going, I'm being chased, you know. Nightmares.
You know, with all this technology... When you were talking, Martin, about, you know, it all comes down to inspiration, and I can just imagine what you were saying about walking into, you know, your studio and you have that nice guitar. excuse me. The biggest buzz I've had in a long time with gear is I bought my first electric guitar.
Yeah.
You know, and I can't tell you how cool it was to do my research and to go to Guitar Center, and I'm not a guitar player, right? But I just got this buzz into wanting to get a guitar, and I looked at all the different guitars and I played them and I looked at the ones that were my budget, and I bought a Fender and I bought a Strat, and I tell you, as soon as I got home, I found myself just starting to write, just starting to think about chords in a different way, and I have a little chord book and I bought a little amp. Actually, it's about this size, you know. Right. It's about the size of a PDA, but a little cord thing.
That's a great technology. We're also going to put some headphones in.
Exactly. And it was – and so there's – you know, mm-hmm. I know we spent this last half hour talking about all different types of technology. But, you know, when it comes down to it, there's still certain classic pieces that you'll catch a buzz and that will
– and never go away because they actually illustrate skill of the player. You know, there's something unique about it.
Not my guitar.
Well, but it is, you see. It's a human thing. You're having to put your fingers on some strings and you have to strum. That's really, really, really special. And it's actually become more special now because it's not demanded much. So we find ourselves going back, you know, and going, oh, look at that Vox amp. You know, that was such a great amplifier. But what that's doing, it's really showing us that there were some great things that were made in the past, some great things. And you don't really want to wipe over those. You can't really wipe over those. They were great things. I mean, it's irrational to think that everything made in the past isn't good now and we need new technology to go past it. Yeah, we need to keep moving. But sometimes it gets into, to me, it gets into gadget. And you go in a Guitar Center and you see, you know, all the guitars, and then you go into the professional area where they're doing all the software, and you can just keep getting more software. But you go back to the guitars, and you're still buying one great guitar. And I think that still shows after all the years that we're still entranced by some things which were really good. And it takes a lot of skill to not be upgrading continuously at a pace, because, particularly for me as a writer. I'm sure, you know, I don't want to say that technology isn't going to help me as a writer down the line, but I do think it's a very dangerous quicksand to get into as a writer, to get into the technology in front of the human creativity.
Okay, quick question for the panel, and I'll ask each of you. What was the last piece of gear that you bought that inspired you? What was it?
A Taylor acoustic guitar.
Scott, what about you? What was the last piece of gear that you bought that inspired you?
You know, I hate to say it. I'm a technocrat, so I like a lot of the technologies.
Just pick one.
Oh, goodness. Some of the location recording devices that are, you know, the size of a deck of cards. That does like 192, 24-bit.
Like the M-Audio?
M-Audio, the 744 by Sound Devices. Just being able to have something. I mean, but there's so many controllers. There's the Novations controller, which has a lot of great stuff that I like. Plugins that now all of a sudden I can fit really. I have
Scott's
a lot of
inspired by all of Guitar Center.
I'm the kind of guy that, you know, goes to an AM show and actually, you know, the heart races a little bit. You know, not quite like sex, but just, you know, I gotta get out of
here. Rob, last piece of gear that inspired you.
Actually, it's going to sound a little strange, but I just recently added a ton of inputs to my Pro Tools system, which is my main mixing console. And that made it where I could hook up a lot of gear simultaneously, a lot of keyboards, a lot of separate virtual instruments going. And that ability to now not have to worry about what's hooked up at any given moment or even get out of the chair to change things around. In other words, I could just sit in front of the screen and have basically every sound I can imagine. And I do agree with what Martin was saying. You don't want to have this unlimited palette, but I have, when I start writing, I have a small palette that I like to have up, and I never used to be able to have it all available. And that palette could include everything from drums and loops to symphonic orchestra sounds and choirs and just a lot of different stuff. I do a lot of different kinds of music. And having these extra inputs has inspired me because it's made the initial writing process easy. Because I've sat down some mornings and not been sure whether I'm writing a pop song or a symphony kind of piece. And it's just nice to be able to have all that stuff up and not worry about anything except what notes I want to hear and what instruments I want to hear. It's more like being in a room with the orchestra and band and just picking who I want to hear from.
You know, that's great, because what you're talking about is a technology that's an enabler. It basically enabled you to work in a specific way to allow you to be creative.
Well, the other thing I want to point out that kind of ties into it as well is, you know, I've definitely embraced virtual instruments. And I use them a lot, but a lot of people have lost sight of the fact that having a piece of software that has a picture of an instrument is not the same necessarily as the instrument that's supposed to be emulating. And I have a lot of the hardware synths that I also have the virtual instrument versions of. And in most cases, the original instrument sounds way, way better. I mean, the virtual instrument is always more convenient and has a lot of features. Some of the old analog instruments don't have memory or even MIDI. So the virtual instruments are more convenient, but there's nothing like the sound of the original analog, especially compared to the virtual instruments. You know, you can have an emulation of a Moog or the real Moog, and it's not even a subtle difference. I think a lot of people just don't even realize that because they haven't had the chance to play with the original. But
I think
try.
Something you said, which is important, is convenience and
everything I said was important. which part did you find most important?
But the convenience, the convenience and the instant gratification, I think has. On one hand, has made life easier where you've been able to record it. Before, it used to be, I need to book a recording studio and I got to plan it out. I got to think it all ahead. Now, a lot of these things, you can wake up any time of the day and put your ideas down. You can do production. You have orchestras at the tip of your fingers. But I think sometimes technology for technology's sake is like, why do we need this? One of the amazing things I saw, and I'm going to date myself, when the DX7 first came out, there was a guy that walked around with the caddy, the cartridge caddy. And this was great because I was demoing at that point the DX7 for some company. And this guy comes out and says, you know, I don't know if you guys want this. It was a little molded piece of plastic that fit into the side of your DX7 to hold all your cartridges because there was nowhere to put them. He sold out everything he ever made at the NAMM show in one day. Yeah. Everybody went, what a great idea. Gone. Because everybody had the same problem. Where do you put the cartridge? And one of the things that showed me was what I think is amazing on the technology used correctly is solving a problem. Problem solving. How can I make your life easier to fill in the blank?
Mm-hmm. Hey, and on that, we're going to take a break because when we come back, we're going to talk about alternative controllers and how people are trying to make themselves more convenient ways of mixing and of creating music and other things. So we'll see you on the other side.
Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And right now, that noise you heard was Andrew, our engineer, is joining us.
And he's a little drunk, so he's knocking things over.
I'm all right, really.
Okay. Andrew Chavone, we're going to be talking about alternative controllers. And the reason why I wanted Andrew to come out here, other than, you know, we got to give him some recognition for engineering each and every podcast.
Actually, do we have to applaud? He's going to get to speak for himself now.
but he also – he's a really great electronica musician and does a lot of stuff with electronica and techno. And, well, you can pretty much tell people what you've done and
– I like to control it in as many ways as possible. I really enjoy Reactor. And but when I had time on my hands – I used to use Max MSP. Now that I don't have time and I live in Los Angeles, I don't know if I'll ever get back to that piece of software. Yeah. But I like Live. It's easy to use, and there's lots of different ways to use it. Mm-hmm.
So one thing I wanted to talk about is we had a really great discussion beforehand about technology and just its place in the whole process. And I don't know if you guys noticed, but more and more there are people that are approaching not only the creation of music but the production of music in different ways. And people are always coming up with alternative ways to write and to create and to compose and to mix. And I wanted to talk about a little bit about some of these ways. I mean, how many times have you gone to a NAMM show and you always see that brand new instrument that you don't know what the heck it is?
Well, usually they're downstairs.
Yes, that's right.
In the weirdo hall. And usually at the first NAMM show you see the device, you usually see an exuberant inventor showing it off, you know, some crazy instrument. And then at the next NAMM show, he's a little thinner. And then two or three NAMM shows later, he's gone. That's usually the way it goes.
You got to hand it to these guys that – like this last NAMM show, actually the one before last, did you see that tube thing where you had all those sensors on
it? Yeah.
And you just turn it and it changes keys just by turning it?
It was absolutely unplayable.
Was it really?
I tried it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess, well, the guy who invented it could play it, but, you know.
But he's very thin now.
Yeah, right. I think he may be gone now.
Was it like a playable keyboard kind of thing? Or what was the tube?
It was a cylinder.
It was a cylinder and it had all these. Touch pads. And you're right. He was playing it and
It wasn't. It wasn't like sequential notes. I think it was set up as a circle of fifths around it. Mm-hmm. And he played like rhythmic melodies with it. And it was pretty cool. I mean, it was nothing you couldn't play on a keyboard, but.
It was kind of like the Chapman stick. I mean, that's this acoustic version where we said, wow, and handful of people can do amazing things on it, and everybody just started it. And
hey,
said,
I bought one. I still have it.
Martin has one.
Wow.
Yeah. How was it?
You had to learn it very differently, and then it takes a while. But, I mean, I was able to get it onto a few tracks and put it on a few demos, and it was a great sound. But you need to be able to study that. I never had enough patience.
You could dedicate your whole life to getting good at
that. What was phenomenal about it was because it was tuned differently and the intervals were different, you could play some amazing riffs in very small spaces. Mm-hmm. You know, if you emulated what you would do on a bass guitar, you would hear some amazing riffs appearing. Of course, but Tony Levin understood that, you know, 1,000 times more than I would even go with that.
How many strings were on it?
There was a 10-string version and a 12-string version, and there were some other custom ones.
Now,
I have a 10.
Is it a custom tuning or is it a guitar and bass tuning?
No, I think it's been a while. It's like fourths.
Fourths.
For the bass and fifths for the guitar.
I mean, you were playing chords, you know, on some of the strings and then playing bass lines below that. And, of course, you had to be, you know, you had to learn.
Was it like an open E tuning kind of thing?
You know, it's a long time since I've got it in the loft at the moment, hidden away. But I remember having
it sold too. Pull
out the pamphlet and read it and think, my God, the tuning of this. This is, you know, and of course you start to play the same kind of fingering as you would on a normal bass.
Yeah, it doesn't work.
It doesn't work at all.
I actually ended up using it mostly for bass because I was able to it's sort of like playing a keyboard.
Yeah.
You know, so as a keyboard player, it was easier for me to figure that out than a regular electric
bass. And of course,
bass.
I ended up sampling it.
Now, my question is, since it had an alternative tuning, I bet it was hard to hear whether or not it was in tune or not in tune.
Well, no. It's not that it had an alternative
just chromatic.
Tuning. I mean, it was still chromatic.
Oh, okay.
It was just, the strings weren't sequentially the same as a guitar or a bass. Although there were people who tuned it, as a guitar or bass to make themselves feel more comfortable. You could tune it that way. But Emmett Chapman's recommendation wasn't that. He had his own set tuning. But I heard a lot of different people play it over the years who had their own favorite tunings. It's all what you get used to.
And, of course, you're playing it with your left hand. I mean, you're really hammering. It's more hammering than anything else. So, you know, your left hand is also, you know, a percussive instrument on it. That makes it sound so good.
I sat at the NAMM show, and the guys that they have at the NAMM show were just phenomenal. I've always been, like, just to see somebody play that. And I also saw it one time.
Well, they're not going
to
wheel out some joker who can't play an octave.
No, I know. That's true,
too. You know, do you remember the – oh, for the guitar players out there, Ebo.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody bought one. No one got it to work.
No, we
get it to work, but you're like –
Well, we worked with Brian?
No,
Brian?
Neil,
the guitarist. Neil used it.
In my band, Neil was really good at playing that. Some guitarists really had the touch. And then I would pick it up and go like, where's it gone? It's not.
But you know what? That guy's still at every NAMM show and he doesn't look hungry.
Well, everyone bought one because you had to.
It's very cool.
But the guys that know how to use it, that's really cool. Neil knew how to use it.
Neil Taylor. He's playing now with Robbie Williams, but he knew totally how to make that sound like bagpipes and haunting. And, you know, then I take the guitar in my own hand, and I would have to check to see if the light was on because it wasn't working for me.
Oh, man, that's funny. The other place I saw that Chapman Stick wanted to get back is I was in San Francisco, and a street performer had a Chapman Stick, and this guy was awesome. And I'm like, wow, that's amazing, you know? So, of course, it probably –
it's an amazing instrument, but it's a lifetime to really master.
Next to the cube with the plastic buckets.
Well, one thing I want to talk about is, you know, when you talk about alternative controllers for music, you cannot avoid the old mouse versus faders in the whole mixing realm. And I know, Martin, you went from mixing, you know, on your Soundcraft to mixing strictly with a mouse. And why don't you tell us a little bit about your experience and just that whole debate in general, you know?
Well, I came to the whole picture of that thinking that I would always have to be mixing with faders, and I was sure that would be the way it was. But I was going to learn Pro Tools through your help, Mike, at my studio, and learn the new digital recording. And then when I really studied that, really what I was looking at on the screen was a picture of, you know, 90 channels of a board that I dreamt I'd always had, like, you know, an SSL board, and started to play around. I was amazed at how quickly I fell in love with just mixing in the box. Everybody has said to me, I mean, it came to a point when I was a little baffled why I would need a controller, because I was thinking, well, the mixers are sounding good. I'm able to get really good detail here. I'm using automation for the first time, really, because I was using a 56-channel Soundcraft board. And I could understand some of the mixers I'd worked with that said, you really will need to feel the faders and feel you're playing it like an instrument. And I sort of went along with that. But with the hours that I stayed on my own learning, Pro Tools and the sequencers and playing with the mouse, I just found that it satisfied me totally. And I've been doing that now for over a year. And I found some of the mixes I've been doing in the box tremendous. I have no problem with having to use a large controller, and I have thought about it and thought, well, that it might be easier in the big picture, but it's pretty amazing in a small space. You've got, you know, over 100 tracks, you've got SSL software that sounds pretty good, and everything is automated. Now, for someone like me, you know, who really came from the other older world of analog, I thought there's no way that I'm going to enjoy mixing, as they said, in the box. I didn't even know what mixing in the box meant. I thought I had to wear something or something over my head or something.
Well,
I didn't get it.
I remember when we were first doing the transition on your studio, your biggest thing was, I remember you were telling me about, well, I comp my vocals, and I'm really good at comping my vocals, and you were working those faders, you know, like there was a typewriter. Yeah. And then I was saying, Martin, you're going to totally comp in a whole different way. It's going to be a whole new world. Yeah. And I remember when you just, you couldn't put that together because you were really worried about your faders.
Yeah, I really thought I was the best vocal comper in the universe, not just the world. I thought I was brilliant. Yeah, I did really
well. There's a guy on Galactica 3 who's
and I thought, you know, I'm really proud of this, the way I comp vocals.
You know what? I will say, I'm just, you know, he's pretty good. He would go live. Okay, he had a 24-inch, I mean 24, he had a 24-track. Wow, there's an edit.
I like the way that sounded.
he had a 24-track tape machine, and he was comping, you know, he was doing a bounce from like 8 takes live.
Wow.
As he's doing his faders, and I'm like, and on syllables, it's like I could never do that. I mean, I think I'm a really good Pro Tools editor, but I could never ever do that live. And you did that on your albums.
I lived doing that all the time, so that was a big thing to me. And I thought, there's no way, even though everything's going to get easier, supposedly on a screen, they won't. I understood the studio, the tape. I understood how it felt to use those faders. But I must admit, after you taught me, Mike, how to do that with through Pro Tools and with a mouse, after a good month, I started to see the real benefits of how closely, even closer, I could actually do comping, and how I could really get even nearer to what I was trying to do with sound waves, you know, and seeing everything on the screen was a huge thing for me. I mean, there was a time when I just I was against it, but then when I saw the vocals on the screen and I was actually cutting them up and crossfading them, it was a bit like you know, a revelation to me. I had a religious experience and thought, I can do this too. So to sum this all up, I have no need. I feel at this stage in having a big board. I'm very happy mixing and looking at two screens in front of me that emulate a board. I'm quite happy with that.
So you don't? I was just going to say, you don't see yourself going back to faders or even
that. You know, I think that, you know, if a project that I was doing at home moved out into a bigger place, in the sense that we were doing drums live, and maybe a certain mixer I was working with that wanted to work that way, I could see myself doing that. But, you know, I've become very self-sufficient, and everything I've taken out of my studio that I've mixed in the computer and just automated it with the mouse, because I came at this. This is very interesting, actually. I came at this late, and so I was very baffled after I was using the mouse why people wanted to use controllers. I was like, well, I'm doing it all. It's happening. What else are we going to get from this? You know, when the icon came out, I was sort of sat there looking at it going, well, what's the icon really going to do for me? It's just a great big version of a mouse, you know. I was thinking I was missing something. But the test is, everything I took out of my studio, I was very happy with. And I found that the automation with Pro Tools was very intricate. And I felt like I didn't need more, something bigger in front of me. You know, I didn't need anything large because it was in the screens. And I agree with what we were saying early on. I think the screen should be large enough to feel that you're seeing everything clearly. But I thought, when I was getting back to this again, that when I was learning it, I'd like to use the mouse. But then when I got to a certain stage, Mike, I'd say, okay, now onto the big boards. But it didn't happen that way. I was like, no. This is fine, you know. I it's intricate and it's good.
You know, I have a technology inertia story like yours too, about, you know, you used to comp the vocals and you'd ride the faders, and how could there be a better way?
Yeah.
And in my early days, I used to tune a lot of vocals for people using a harmonizer, you know, real early harmonizer that had the first pitch algorithms, and it had that big wheel. It's like a 2-inch wheel. And I used to listen, and I'd listen to the vocal for like a whole verse, and I would learn, okay, they're a little flat there, a little sharp there, a little flat there, a little sharp there. And I would actually play it, and I'd practice it, I'd rehearse it, and it got to the point where I could get through a whole verse and perform the pitch correction. And I used to do this a lot.
Wow.
And I thought, well, this is just the coolest way to do this, and, you know, I'm the dude. You know, I really have this down. And for a while...
and me were the best in the universe. We were the best.
No, that guy in Galactic 3, amazing pitch corrector. Yeah. No, I was second.
But you know what? Different controllers.
But,
love,
you know, let me just finish. I was going to say, then, like, Andrew Sheps, I think, is one of the first people who showed me the first auto-tune plugin or whatever it was back then. Yeah. And I just realized,
I am an expert at something that's about to completely disappear. And I immediately adopted the new way of doing it. But
I want to jump in here about this auto correction on the vocals, though, because I've been playing around with that as well. And you really can hear when a voice is
definitely
being, even when you lay it off to, you know, like this 0.30, which is supposed to be just touching it, you can tell that this thing is on it. I've actually gone against it recently. I thought, like, everything sounds too smooth, and it's actually affecting the sound, and it's got me down a little bit, mm-hmm. I must admit. It's exciting at first, because you go, oh, everything's in tune. Quite good on guitars, if you guys, you know, if you want to do that. But I found it on vocals a little bit cold.
You know what? Melodyne has changed the world when it comes to pitch correction and tuning and stuff, and that right now, a lot of people don't know about it, but it's the state of the art.
Is it?
For that kind of technology.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
auto-tune at this point, you can...
Do you feel the same
tell.
Way? That
oh, absolutely.
Even when you're just, you know, on the just touching it, yeah. You go like something else is happening. The tone is changing.
You know what? It's the same thing as when people take all the breaths out of the vocal because they think it sounds like noise. You know, it's not
being human.
I never
did that
because
I was the best in the world.
Hell of a breather. Okay. That's what I've heard.
Well, listen.
See? Magic. Pure magic.
Well, getting back to alternative controllers.
You know,
is that where we were?
I don't know. So one of the things I was going to say is that one of the things I've done, and Rob knows I've had a lot of different types of controllers. For me...
Yeah, he's one of the people who buys all the weird stuff.
Yeah, I've got all the weird stuff, because what I do is... like, for instance, I did a movie years ago called True Lies. And what I ended up doing... And in some ways, I've had cooler tricks years ago that I'm trying to come back to. Mm-hmm. Because we use samplers. So I was using, like, octopads... For the a pod gun on the Harrier jet is me doing paradiddles with machine guns. Another thing I did is like I've got a Harrier jet recording and it's going on and on through a whole scene.
Wait, you were doing paradiddles?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
How come paradiddles? I mean, did you want that uneven?
Well, no, because the thing is a real gun goes
right,
and it's just boring. So I had James Cameron in there and I go, do you like it this way? Or you know, and I tried different performances, and I actually, through that whole movie, played with drumsticks all the guns.
That's cool.
To try to get the right cyclic rate, it doesn't exist. The pod gun doesn't sound like that. It goes, because it's shooting so many bullets, it gets tonal. But that's boring. Same thing with the Harrier jet. A Harrier jet sounds like a dustbuster. Like, put your neck next to a dustbuster, that's a Harrier jet, just really loud. So... I've got this dustbuster. Schwarzenegger's moving all over it. It's doing all these tricks. And there's really – Harrier jet has no sound. So what I did two different techniques. I had something called a HOTS controller, which is which was originally made for Mick Fleetwood. And it was a vest that he can actually tap. And it was this kind of like this cloth that had pressure-sensitive pads. So I've got it stretched out on this little box. And what I did was I put my graphic equalizer on each different pads. So as I'm moving it, I can change the different EQ attributes as watching the screen and perform it. Another thing I did was with a light beam. So as I'm moving my hand over the light beam, I've got different type of pitching, different type of filtering. So I'm actually performing that whole Harrier jet live.
Mm.
So
that's cool. So the Harrier jet,
Jet's all live.
See, now I got to go buy that movie.
So you know, you try different things, and for me, you know, I've been doing that.
Did
for
the credits
years.
Say Harrier jet played by?
Played by, yes.
Thank you very much.
He was the best in the galaxy.
In the galaxy playing Harrier.
But you know, something. It's another good instance, and that's name drop stuff. But Cliffhanger, they had a helicopter, and they kept changing the speed of the film. So I couldn't go. So what I did was I watched it, figured it out, and again, back on the drums, each blade hit is me playing it. I go slower, faster, because your ear can start hearing rhythm changes, even different than the visuals. So I'd figure out where sync was, and then I'd have to go, from point A to point B and change speed without the audience knowing the speed was changing.
So you were doing this live on stage then?
I was doing it in my room, but at that time, there wasn't Pro Tools. It was a Waveframe 1000.
Right.
And it was wonderful, and I was triggering these, came up with these lush, thick elements. I also did the Perfect Storm. And what happens is, once it got the sequence in, I can then start going through the different elements of the blade wops, the hits, the whooshes, all that, and start mixing it so it was never the same thing over and over. And everybody thought, my God, you put a mic out, and it was, you know, nobody. Yeah. It's the man behind
everybody
the,
thinks it's the, production sound.
Yeah, it's the man behind the.
That is so cool. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it's funny that you're saying that you're now looking for those techniques to go back to some of those.
Well, because what happened was when I left the waveframe and left the world of sampling, you know, you got into the microscopic editing of Pro Tools. So I had all the control over the tracks. But then I started realizing more recently that there were some really cool things I was doing years ago that I'm not doing anymore. So, but one thing great about the waveframe was you can call up a session and your disc recorder came up, your mixer came up, your sampler came up. It was all together. Then I really, you know, I had EMUs, I had EMU4s and EMU5000s and all these stuff, but it was still another device with another library, with another support. You know, we're talking about data support. It just wasn't worth it. Then Contact 2 came out, and now all of a sudden I've got my waveframe 1000 back. So now I've got, you know, all my hundreds of tracks of Pro Tools with a really cool sampler, and I'm like, hey, I should go back in and start, you know, going back to these really cool tricks.
Yeah.
So, and Core, one of the reasons I bought a Control 24 was not as a mixing unit, but as a way to control plugins. So now, whether it be graphic EQs, pitches, I can actually manipulate, using faders, all my plugins in real time and automate it to get really cool, unique, you know, sound design, whether it be musical or effects.
Well, that's, I mean, I can definitely see how using alternative controllers for all that has definitely changed how you approach your sound design now.
Yeah, and we've all started talking, you know, about the Core, Native Instruments Core. I'm very fascinated to see that because now it's another device that allows me to tweak.
Oh, by the way, Native Instruments was supposed to be here, but due to some scheduling conflicts, that we rescheduled them for August. So they will be here. Todd will be here, just not today. One of the reasons why Andrew, you know, I wanted to bring Andrew here too, is he's been looking at some alternative controllers for music, and they have a hardware sequencer that Andrew's been lusting after because I always see him look at it on the internet and. And it's a hardware sequencer. I mean, I haven't seen hardware sequencers since and I don't mean like computer data.
Yeah, the R2500.
No, no. I mean like
you mean
literally
back in the old days.
Back in the old days where you're turning on the notes on a hardware. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that? What was the name of that one that we were looking at?
I forget who makes that one, but it's called the Octopus. And you have a circle of knobs. It's kind of like a spiral. It's just like kind of looks like a spiral galaxy, and that's how you enter in all of your data and you switch between all the different pages and things like that. But then you have I think you have 16 rows with 16 buttons across, and you know the top is note, pitch, velocity, yada yada yada, glide and whatnot, and you can go through all the different pages. And I think there's 4 or 5 different colors of the light, so it's very easy to see it whether you're on stage or from a distance. And
is it a synth also, or it's controlling other synths?
It's just a controller. But
there's no keys. It's all LEDs, and you can punch. It's weird. You can like. You punch the buttons down to get your notes, like the good old days where you used to have like sequential circuits where you used to have the notes on or the notes off, you know, feeding into the big, you know, whatever the CV, you know, whatever was being controlled by the CV. But it was really amazing. The other thing that's really amazing about that is it's also like $3,600.
Yeah.
It's like, but really, this kind of gets back to what we were talking about, even starting with the PDA. I mean, people nowadays, like Scott, I mean, did you ever think when you were first studying that you're going to be sitting there playing, you know, drums essentially to do your sound effects? I mean, the way technology is going with the alternative controllers. My question is, why are the fader guys so threatened by the mouse mixers out there? I mean, if you get a bunch of mixers in a room and you talk about fader versus the mouse, I mean, these guys get really passionate. I mean, what's up with that?
Well, but you know, I came from a mixing background. I will say that I use both, but there's something I like faders actually more than mice, but also what fader? I mean, every fader to me has a different feel, has a different touch, because when you're sitting there, especially with multiple faders, and you I think good mixers play the mixing console, where they're not moving the console, but they're sitting there. They can actually feel the sound. So when you move it up, you can actually feel it. But it's not saying that a mouse can't do that, because when you start transcending your interface device and you start thinking about what you want to do, and it happens, and the device that you're doing it with, I mean, Rob does stuff on a keyboard that I've seen very few people do, because he transcends it. He's not thinking, I'm going to physically do this. He just thinks about what he wants to do, and it comes out because he's so agile on the keyboards. I think the same thing with a good console, with a good fader, with the right kind of mouse. It's the same thing that hates in video games with a good joystick, just getting that right nuance that you can control.
I think that a lot of people get caught up in the argument the same way people get caught up in a Mac versus PC argument or anything
right.
else.
Right.
People, no one wants to be ever proven wrong and think that they're doing things the wrong way, and everybody will defend the way they do things. And
it really comes down to the just, person.
Yeah, it's an ego thing. Pretty much. I think so, because I've seen great people. I've seen people do great work with either mixing with mouse or faders.
Yeah, I don't think it, one's right, one's wrong.
No, I don't think so either.
At all.
I mean, if you want to grab 10 different sounds and have some of them go up and some of them down, and you want to do that in real time live, yeah, you have to have faders.
But it really comes down to this. As artists, it's what you enjoy working with is really the key.
Yeah, it's whatever frees your creativity.
You know, some people only can work with a Steinway of a certain, you know, Bosendorf, and I think nothing else works.
I think a lot of people could do both at the same time. I'm quite happy to get onto a board and work with a board as well as, and now a mouse. You know, both of them to me, you know, my thing was I thought the mouse wouldn't work and it wouldn't be as good, but I found it to be fine for me.
What happens to you, though, you know, when, oh, actually, I guess mice don't do it, but you know trackballs, and they start slipping?
Mm-hmm.
Where they don't, like, you move in it. Mm-hmm. The most distressing thing for me, because I use trackballs a lot, and you move in it, and you don't even know that you're using a trackball.
Yeah.
You're just moving this thing around. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, the trackball in one of the X or Y coordinates doesn't quite track.
Yeah.
So you're sitting there, and it's the most angst feeling, because all of a sudden you're like, it's
well, you've
not.
Been disconnected from your universe.
Oh, yeah.
I tell you what I found really good, though, in the difference of using the screen and with Pro Tools and using the mouse, is I've been using numbers a great deal. You know, but by looking at the numbers and thinking, I just want to move this up by one or two.
Yeah.
And that's been very useful to me, instead of looking at the old thing and thinking, I think I've pushed up enough here. It's been quite useful to me, and I fought this a little while, thinking, you know, I don't want to deal with numbers. But it has been useful to say, I just want that, a hair on that.
Well,
so
it's also nice,
up by one.
It's also nice to be able to tell when, if you don't like the move you've done, that you can put it back exactly where it was.
You know what the numbers are. I agree with that. It's psychologically, it's good as well.
So which mouse do you endorse? I mean, which is
you know, I got the I got the mouse that Mike set me up with some time ago, and it's just a normal Apple mouse, I believe. But you get used to it.
You
get used to it, and now that people are saying you need to change that, I'm going like, well, I like the feel of this. You know.
Classic mouse.
Logitech. I like the Logitech mouse. I like a big mouse.
Kensington. No, sorry.
Well, last thing I want to talk about is, do you guys foresee yourself ever using any type of alternative controller to actually make the music?
Oh, hell no. No, I'm kidding.
There goes.
Well, we know you guys tried the Chapman stick.
You know what? I, at every NAMM show, I try all these things. Like, there's that... I forget what it's called, but the keyboard that's made out of the wetsuit material. Did you ever see that?
Yeah, I did.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's really cool and
he's
really
in the back
expensive.
In the left corner.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Exactly.
Pretty much.
Was that the one with all the little lights?
It's red.
Yeah,
it's
it has
red.
black trim with the red.
Yeah.
Is it the keyboard player for Dream Theater? He uses it. He has one on top of his controller.
Actually, I'm not even
Rudis?
Sure.
Yeah. Have you seen
it?
I
mean, it's
it's interesting. It's fun. And it's cool to play
it's
with.
Like, tap your jacket, tap your clothes.
But is it practical? I mean, maybe occasionally you'd think of something to use it on, but at least for anybody who's doing any kind of mainstream music, it's not going to be easy to squeeze it into most projects. I think those alternative controllers are fun, but usually the real interesting ones are really, really expensive because they're not mass-produced.
Right.
And I've bought over the years a few that I thought were interesting. You know, like little hand percussion triggers and a lot of light beam stuff and, you know, small things, not big $4,000 experimental keyboards. But I just haven't found that many things that you can't get out of a keyboard with, you know, a ribbon controller or light controller or wheels or faders on the
right.
keyboard. there's not too many sounds you can't
get to. I think people look at some of these alternative controllers, and what they're actually looking for is inspiration. Mm-hmm. I think what they're looking for is something to unlock some of their creativity.
And you know what? They do work for that because they force you to think. You know, if you sit down at a piano, that's different than if you pick up an aluminum tube with sensors on it.
But was it with the UI? Was it the trumpet one?
The Yamaha?
No,
the Akai? Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
I mean, there's trumpet controllers that do some amazing things for the people that...
Like the Iwi?
The Iwi was one. And there's a ton of guitar controllers out now that do amazing things.
Guitar controllers are very cool because you just can't... There's no way to control six different notes like that the way you can slide around on a guitar. There's no way to get that out of a keyboard with a controller. I will say that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, as we wrap it up here... You know, if you're in the market for an alternative controller, I think number one, you got to realize that it comes down to the person and what they're going to do with it. You're not going to buy yourself into some great music. At least, yeah, no. I was thinking my guitar, but no, I recorded those songs, and no, that's not great music.
It'll be interesting, actually. You know. In Western civilization, we were brought up with kind of rock and roll, and we picked one of those instruments as our own. But it would be very interesting to PC people in other countries, for all those people in other countries, Africa, different types of percussion, people that are used to very different types of ways of controlling organic acoustic instruments, how they would take to alternative. You know, we were talking about the stick with all the pads on it. For us, it didn't make sense because there's nothing like it. Yeah. Meanwhile, there's people that have been playing maybe percussive things in South America or Africa that may go, you know what, this makes total sense to me.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
You know what, there are plenty of keyboards now where you can change the scaling so that 12 notes doesn't equal an octave. You know, set it so 24 notes equal an octave so that you can play quarter tones. If you want inspiration... You're going to get some. You can come up with some incredibly strange stuff using gear you already have because most keyboards can do that already.
All right. Well, we're going to wrap this one up, this podcast on technology, alternative controllers, and how Scott made the sound of the Harrier jet. I just want to remind you guys that if you want to actually join us here in some of these conversations, you can always email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And we do read them. And I want to give a shout out to Vanessa because she was the...
Yo, Vanessa.
She sent us a really great email. That was the one that I sent to everybody. Mm-hmm. And it was just really great. And guys, we do read your emails. And before we get going, last question I want to ask everybody. What was the last really good record that you guys bought? Because I just bought the new Keane album. I love it. It's an awesome album.
Yeah, I enjoy the Keane record. I'm not crazy about the tone of the record. I think it's a very bright record, but it's good songwriting again. But I've recently been going back a little bit and looking at some of the classic songwriters from the past. So I've just been getting into Woody Guthrie, just hearing how the songs from the land were written in those days, and that's been quite inspiring to me going back acoustically.
Great, Scott.
Oh, you're going to hand it over to me?
Well, because I'm trying to think.
Well, actually, I've been absolutely swamped with work, and then with a 10-day vacation in the middle, I haven't bought any music in the last couple months. Yeah. I have actually been listening to just older school stuff, like old Earth, Wind, and Fire, and I haven't had much time to just recreationally listen to music, but when I do have a moment, that's what I find myself going back to.
Yeah, I must mention here as well, there's a great record out by a guy called Teddy Thompson, and he's the son of Richard Thompson, and he's brought out a really exceptional record, I think, great singer. And I just recently saw the biography on Leonard Cohen that's showing now, and he performs it's got different artists performing Leonard Cohen songs, and that's a good film to check out as well, for checking on inspiration where Leonard Cohen writes from.
That's great, because you guys, you know what, we're going to do this at the end of every podcast, by the way. I'm going to ask you what the latest CD, Andrew.
Well, the latest CD that I've been listening to is actually the new Flaming Lips album, which I really like. It's kind of a different sound. There's one thing that they do is they play a distorted sound. I think they drive like a big amplifier with a really low wattage head, and it has this really kind of grimy sound, which I've been getting into. trying to incorporate it into my own music, so I've been listening to that more and more.
That's cool. Scott.
Okay, I remembered. I was going, what's the name of the band? No, you know what it was? After we had met with Andrew, I was really, I hadn't heard the Chili Peppers album, and I wanted to hear it, and I do like the Chili Peppers. And actually, I think the last two albums that I liked quite a lot, I guess, you know, was Chili Peppers and also the Foo Fighters. Came out with an album just recently that I liked the acoustic stuff that they were doing. I don't know. Yeah.
Hey, Andrew's not here, so you can talk about his mix.
The vocals are in tune. And we'll leave it at that.
All right. We'll see you guys next time.
Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. Thanks for listening to this week's edition of the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by West Wave Audio.